Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, John Russell, and Katie Weaver. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
The president of the Japanese Olympic Committee is resigning. Tsunekazu Takeda said on Tuesday he will leave office at the end of his term in June. He also announced plans to resign from the International Olympic Committee. Takeda denied accusations of corruption against him. French officials placed him under investigation last year for suspected corruption in the city of Tokyo's effort to hold the 2020 Summer Olympics. Speaking to reporters Tuesday, Takeda said, "I don't believe I have done anything illegal." The French investigation has had an influence on the way some people look at the Tokyo 2020 Games. Japan is spending at least $20 billion to organize the event, which opens on July 24, 2020. These Summer Olympics may become known as the Robot Games. Last Friday, organizers showed off robots that will be used to provide assistance for people using wheelchairs. Tokyo Olympic official Masaki Komiya noted that Japan is known for its robot technology. He said that the 2020 Games are a good place to show off. "Robots should not overwhelm people," said Komiya, the vice director general to the Tokyo Olympics. "Robots are something that have an amicable relationship with human beings and can work together. The robots are products of Toyota Motor Corporation." Toyota officials said that 16 of what they called human support robots will be used at the National Stadium. 5 other delivery support robots will also be available. At a media event last week, Panasonic Corporation showed off its Power Assist clothing. When worn, the clothes are designed to support the back and help the person wearing them lift heavy objects. Panasonic said 20 of these suits will be used at the Olympics. They could help visitors carrying their belongings and with other lifting duties. I'm Susan Shand.
After a Blockbuster store in Australia closes on March 31st, the American city of Bend, Oregon, will have the only one left on Earth. For years, Blockbuster was a big name in the video rental business. The company had thousands of stores in the United States and around the world. But Blockbuster began to lose money during the 2000s. The company went to court and declared bankruptcy in 2010. By 2014, all company-owned stores had closed. Since then, locally owned Blockbusters have closed, one by one. Operating the soon-to-be-last Blockbuster video on Earth is not easy. The computer system uses old disks that only the store's general manager knows how to use. The video rentals are recorded on a kind of aging tape. The tape cannot be replaced because Radio Shack, another once famous store, went out of business. Sandy Harding has worked at the Blockbuster in Bend for over 15 years and is the store's general manager. She says stubbornness is part of the reason the store is still open. We did everything we could to cut costs and keep ourselves relevant, she said. Zeke Cam lives in Bend. He is making a documentary about the store with his friend. He notes that many people who rented videos over the years want to share memories of their experiences. They remember who they went with and that freedom of walking the aisles, Cam said. Cam explained how Blockbusters were once an important part of small-town America. The Blockbuster was the only place that was open past 9 at night, and a lot of them stayed open much later, he said. So children who weren't hoodlums would come here and look at movies and fall in love with movies. On a recent weekday, Michael Trovato of Melbourne, Australia, stopped by the Blockbuster store in Bend while visiting his twin sister. I miss being able to walk into a Blockbuster or CD store and have that social experience. It's something you don't get from the slick presentation of a music service or, you know, from the internet, he said. The Bend store does not seem to be in danger of closing. Many people stop by to take pictures. The store sells clothing with the words, "Last Blockbuster on the Planet." It even gets gifts from people, including boxes of videotapes, DVDs, and Blockbuster souvenirs. Recently, Harding has noticed that more children are coming to the store, brought in by their parents, who like remembering the past. Jerry Gillis and his wife, Elizabeth, on a trip to Oregon, recently brought their two children, ages 3 and 5, to the store in Bend. They watched with a smile as their children walked from row to row, looking at movies. How could we not stop? It's the last one, said Gillis. They need to see that not everything's on the iPad. I'm John Russell.
As climate change becomes more widely taught in American classrooms, some politicians are fighting for lessons to include information outside of usual scientific theories. A lawmaker from Connecticut wants to remove climate change from state science lessons. A legislator in Virginia worries that teachers are passing on their opinions, not facts, on global warming to their students. And an Oklahoma state senator wants educators to be able to put forward other differing ideas on climate change without fearing job loss. Such efforts are becoming more and more common. The California-based nonprofit National Center for Science Education says more than 10 such bills have been proposed so far this year. That is more than the organization usually sees in a full year. It says the bills threaten the quality of science education in America.
Many of the measures proposed so far in 2019 were designed by two advocacy groups, the Discovery Institute and the Heartland Institute. David Buller, a Republican state senator from Oklahoma, is a former high school teacher. He proposed a bill based on suggested legislation from the Discovery Institute. Science teachers objected, however, and the bill did not move forward. Bullard told the Associated Press, "You have to present two sides of the argument and allow the kids to deliberate." Scientists and science education organizations, however, reject the idea that there are two sides to the issue. You can't talk about two sides when the other side doesn't have a foot in reality, said University of Illinois climate scientist Donald Webbles. More than 90% of the peer-reviewed studies and the scientists who write them say climate change is a human-caused problem.
An international group of Nobel-winning scientists has repeatedly published reports describing the science behind climate change. The scientists explain how the world is likely to pass a level of warming that an international agreement calls dangerous. Last year, the U.S. government issued a detailed report saying that climate-related threats to Americans' physical, social, and economic well-being are rising. Classroom teachings on global warming differ widely from state to state. However, climate change and the ways humans are changing the planet are central subjects in the Next Generation Science Standards. 19 American states and the District of Columbia use the standards. 21 other states use some of the materials. Some people who reject widely accepted climate science have called the debate an issue of academic freedom. James Taylor is with Heartland, a group that dismisses climate change. He said Heartland supports inclusive classroom discussions on the issue. In 2017, the group sent thousands of science teachers copies of a book called Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming. Now, Heartland is more directly targeting its message to students. It is planning to publish a guide this year that says arguments linking climate change to extreme weather events, such as hurricanes and tornadoes, are not correct. Taylor said, "We're very concerned the global warming propaganda efforts have encouraged students to not engage in research and critical thinking."
The Discovery Institute has offered model legislation. It says teachers should be permitted to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of evidence connected to global warming, as well as evolution. Some states have passed similarly written measures in the past, including Tennessee in 2012 and Louisiana in 2008. In other states, Discovery has urged legislators to consider unofficial resolutions in support of giving teachers freedom to show support for critical thinking on dividing issues. Lawmakers in Alabama and Indiana passed such resolutions in 2017. Discovery officials did not answer a request for comment from the Associated Press. Florida State Senator Dennis Baxley, a Republican, is supporting legislation that would permit schools to teach alternatives to disputed theories. There is really no established science on most things, you'll find, Baxley said. Although many details about climate science are hotly debated among scientists, it is well established that global warming is real, human-caused, and a problem, said scientist Chris Field. He is director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Field said, "When people say we ought to present two sides, they're saying we ought to present a side that's totally been disproven, along with a side that has been fundamentally supported by the evidence." I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed four successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the three men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C. on July 2nd, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling, too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19th, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.